This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us today. It's been 90 days since Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. There's still a blackout across much of the island, and it's now the longest in U.S. history. The island's electrical utilities are now operating at 70% capacity, but that does not mean that 70% of Puerto Ricans have power. Meanwhile, the official death toll 3 months after Maria is 64, but that number is now in dispute. The destruction to houses and infrastructure and shortages of food and water had some media outlets skeptical that 64 was an accurate number of dead. Vox was the first to start analyzing death records from the period after the storm, and they concluded that the actual number of dead had to be much, much higher. But the government in Puerto Rico defended its process of counting the dead. Here's Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rosselló early in November.
We have had a very rigorous system of identifying how people have died and if it's directly or indirectly related to the storm. So this is important. We're not only stating in the death toll the people that died because of mudslides and so forth, but also, for example, suicides that the family members attributed to the storm. They're also counted there now. Trying to connect people that, you know, died just of natural causes to that storm is really not appropriate.
That was in November. And since, the New York Times launched an investigation into storm-related deaths, and they now estimate the actual number of dead to be about 1,000. The report helped prompt Governor Rosselló to call for a formal review and a recount of hurricane-related deaths in Puerto Rico. Francis Robles is a correspondent for the New York Times.
I got a tweet yesterday from a woman whose father died. He went to the hospital with respiratory problems, and that hospital didn't have any oxygen because they had run out. Why had they run out? Because the oxygen factory had no power. So he had to be transferred to another hospital, and he died. So do you count something like that as hurricane-related? Well, the people in Puerto Rico would say that you do, because you need to institute a lot of plans for the next hurricane to know, okay, we have to get more oxygen in Puerto Rico. So if you count those types of deaths, then the number of deaths after Hurricane Maria soared to more than 1,000 additional deaths than they had the year before.
So why the huge discrepancy in the government's claim of 64 and the analysis that the New York Times and other media outlets did? Was the government simply counting, you know, trees falling on a person and they die, or a mudslide wipes a car off the road and the person dies, just sort of direct trauma?
That's the part of this whole thing that's been really head-scratching, because the government of Puerto Rico actually does count secondary deaths. If you look at the list of 64, there's people on there that committed suicide. So there is a real disconnect between what they say their definition of a hurricane-related death is and what they're willing to put on the list. The only thing that I can imagine is that the government doesn't want to look like it lost control. I mean, I guess. I don't know, because there's, you know, there was cases that you look at and that any reasonable person would say, hey, look, this person, it was 2 days after the hurricane, they waited 12 hours for an ambulance, they died. You know, how about that? Is that a case? Oh, well, I don't know. It says here on the death certificate that they died of natural causes. So that's been the real hiccup in all of this, is that the cause of death is quote-unquote natural causes on the death certificate. So the people who died of heart attacks waiting in line for gasoline, or the people whose oxygen tanks ran out, or the people who didn't get dialysis for a week, well, those people died of kidney failure. So getting what the government has now decided to do after our reporting is to go through all of those natural deaths, no matter what the death certificate says, and review the circumstances. It's going to be a very exhaustive process. And then the big question is, who are they going to put in charge of that process? Because if they're going to put the same people who for the past 3 months have been insisting, you know, there's nothing to see here, move along, then I don't know how much progress they're going to make.
Well, Francis Robles, you talk about the spin coming from the government of Puerto Rico in the aftermath of the storm. There was some spin coming from the federal government as well. Let me play you the president 2 weeks after the storm, October 3rd, during his visit.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands. You can be very proud of all of your people, all of our people working together. 16 versus literally thousands of people.
That's President Trump, Francis Robles, saying only 16 people had died in Puerto Rico at the time. The literally thousands he's talking about, I think, must be Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana, basically saying that all things considered, Maria was a success story.
Well, giving President Trump the benefit of the doubt, he's working off the information that he's being given on that day, and that was the information that he was being given. But there's a funny thing that happened that day, which I don't know that it's a coincidence. He left. I don't remember what time he left, but a few hours later, the death toll doubled to 32. And everybody was like, come on, the guy was just here and it was 16 and now all of a sudden it's 32. But one of the things that we did, we have an analyst, a graphic analyst at the New York Times named Keenan Davis. He went back and checked from September 20th until October 3rd, the day that Donald Trump visited Puerto Rico. If you go by the number of additional deaths in Puerto Rico day by day, it was already 556 on the day that Donald Trump visited Puerto Rico.
So, Francis, accuracy is vital for accountability here. But what's the bottom line for accountability if the number of dead isn't 64 and it's much closer to 1,000 after Maria? What does that mean?
It means that people need to be held accountable. People need to find out what needs to be done for next time. So there's a press conference that was on November 8th where I start kind of decompensating. I started becoming a little unglued at this press conference, asking exactly what you just asked to the public safety director. And I said to him, don't you have a moral obligation to find out what happened here? If you have an elderly grandparent in Puerto Rico and you want to find out what nursing home to put them in, don't you need to know? Don't you need to know which of the nursing homes didn't have generators or had generators that were, 25 years old and kept breaking, or they didn't have any fuel for their generators? So in effect, they didn't have any generator. We need to know as a society, and people, the hospitals that were not prepared need to be held accountable. And I was met with a big shrug, Todd.
Well, Francis, very few people are shrugging now. Maybe it's a shame that it's taken so long for the kind of accountability that's going to cause the government of Puerto Rico and the federal government to face up to the real toll of Maria. But your work and the work of your colleagues at the New York Times seems to be doing the job. Francis Robles, correspondent at our partner, the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, as people in Puerto Rico struggle to piece their lives back together after Hurricane Maria, there's another crisis on the island that was brewing before the storm even hit. 14 families lose homes every day to foreclosure in Puerto Rico. That's a rate that's more than doubled over the past decade. In all, 90,000 borrowers are estimated to have become delinquent on their mortgages since the storm. Ricardo Ramos Gonzalez is a professor with the Legal Aid Clinic of the University of Puerto Rico's School of Law. He joins me now from San Juan. Ricardo, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you for having me.
Well, there was a bad foreclosure situation in Puerto Rico before the storm hit, and now it's even worse. What can you tell us?
Okay, let me tell you some details about it. Before Maria, we had a potential foreclosure of more than 100,000 homes. That's before Maria. That's due to the fiscal problems we had and the economic problems we had for the last decade. So we really had a big problem that not too many people talk about it then, okay? So what happened after Maria is that everything came to the open. And now, afterwards, we're in a very big problem. 250,000 homes were affected. 70,000 homes were destroyed. Over 30,000 people unemployed because of the hurricane. Thousands of small businesses closed. I mean, it's really a big situation we have here.
And remind us, Ricardo, just how big the foreclosure threat is now. It was about 90,000 before the storm. How big is it now?
I would say it can get close to 200,000 homes in foreclosure potential in Puerto Rico right now.
Now, there was a temporary moratorium on foreclosures. Has that helped? The moratorium was set to expire soon, I think at the end of the month.
Yes. It depends what kind of loan there is. Like, for instance, FHA extended the moratorium to 6 months, so it will expire in March 2018. The other ones will expire in December 31st, this month. So after January 1st, there could be some struggles here if something is not done about it.
Do a lot of people in Puerto Rico have federal mortgage loans, those FHA loans?
Yes, more than 100,000.
So the federal government could take some action here and help relieve this problem?
Well, they could take action always because not only FHA, we also have Fannie Mae loans, Freddie Mac loans, that's part of the U.S. government right now. So if all of them get together in a common cost and extend the moratorium, let's say, for 12 months in forbearance payments and also in foreclosures, yes, it would help. Something similar was done by law during the Great Depression in the 30s. And really, what we have here is an economy of war. I mean, this is a war zone.
Ricardo, talk a little bit more about what help might be available to people. We're used to hearing about FEMA grants and FEMA loans for people to rebuild their roofs and their properties. You're really talking about rebuilding people's finances so that they can pay the mortgage in the first place. It's kind of a different situation.
Yes, it's different because if you don't have any home whatsoever and you have had insurance, there's a process, I think, to take place in order to rebuild your home. But if you have your house, but you have no income, okay, and you don't get any help except for those 3 months that they're giving in forbearance or halt any foreclosure which already started in place, then there is no alternative. The hope that you have is very slim, so we need some kind of progressive and total plan that will deal with that problem.
Have you heard this message being reflected through lawmakers, either your representative in Congress there from Puerto Rico or other allied lawmakers from Florida and other places, basically carrying the message that you're talking about, getting FHA and Fannie Mae and all of these federally backed agencies together to stave off foreclosures and keep people in their homes?
No. Nobody has talked about this. I've been trying to get in contact and I've spoken to local politicians and legislators to see if they can, by law, do some kind of moratorium a la Great Depression style, but hasn't gone too far already.
And nobody in Washington's talking about it?
No, not at all. They're talking about reconstructing the electricity grid, the telecommunications, and some other things, but this kind of situation, no one has heard about talking about this.
Ricardo Ramos-Gonzalez with the University of Puerto Rico School of Law, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Todd. Thank you for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.